From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Richard Price about making Mad Dog and Glory. Price is the executive producer and screenwriter of this new movie, which stars Robert De Niro and Bill Murray. Price also wrote the screenplays for Sea of Love and The Color of Money. Also today, the deficit. The president is asking us to make financial sacrifices so he can cut the deficit. What is it? Why is it so big? And what does it matter? We'll talk with Robert Krulwich, economics correspondent for CBS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The House continues to debate the first parts of President Clinton's budget proposals at this hour. Members of Congress are discussing an overall budget resolution, as well as the president's economic stimulus program. Earlier today, the House rejected a Republican alternative to the Clinton administration's plan. The Republican measure would have cut spending by $429 billion over the next 5 years and dropped all of President Clinton's tax increases. Debate on the presidential plan is expected to continue well into the evening. Stepping up its efforts to resolve the crisis in Haiti, the Clinton administration is sending a senior diplomat to the capital city of Port-au-Prince. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Ambassador Charles Redmond has been asked to serve for a limited time as special chargé d'affaires in Port-au-Prince, where the U.S. currently has no resident ambassador. Redmond's principal duty? To support negotiations aimed at restoring democracy in Haiti. Negotiations sponsored by the United Nations and the Organization of American States. Redmond is the second veteran diplomat assigned to the Haiti crisis. While he works the problem there, Ambassador Lawrence Pezzullo will operate from a Washington base as the Secretary of State's special advisor on Haiti. Redmond, who has served as U.S. Ambassador to Sweden, is perhaps better known to Americans as the State Department spokesman during the final years of the Reagan administration. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee says the panel will open hearings on President Clinton's controversial plan to lift the ban on homosexuals in the military at the end of this month. Senator Sam Nunn, who supports the ban, says committee members will visit military installations to get the views of service personnel. The Senate ordered the hearings last month after the massive publicity on the presidential effort to lift the ban. Anti-abortion protesters returned to a Pensacola women's clinic today for the first time since a doctor was killed during a demonstration there last week. Debbie Elliott reports.
About a dozen anti-abortion demonstrators picketed peacefully outside Pensacola Women's Medical Services for the first time since Dr. David Gunn was shot to death as he arrived at the clinic last Wednesday. Protest leader John Burt says the demonstrators are not going to stop, in his words, as long as babies are being killed. At an arraignment hearing earlier today, Michael Griffin pleaded not guilty to a first-degree murder charge. Police say he admitted shooting Dr. Gunn. About 20 abortion rights activists picketed outside the courthouse where Griffin was arraigned. That demonstration was planned by the National Organization for Women to show support for abortion rights and in memory of Dr. Gunn. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed higher today, gaining almost 39 points to finish the day at 3465.64. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1, that in heavy trading of 240 million shares. This is NPR News. Government officials say the nation's schoolchildren are facing a danger in the classroom from radioactive radon gas. In congressional testimony today, officials from the Environmental Protection Agency said almost one of every five schools in the U.S. has dangerous levels of radon gas. More than 70,000 classrooms in more than 15,000 public schools have radon levels that exceed the EPA safety standard. During the hearing, a California congressman said that in some schools, going to class may be more hazardous than working in a nuclear power plant. After months of confusion, the Clinton administration has told the nation's colleges and universities that they can continue offering scholarships to students on the basis of race. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
In a letter addressed to 7,500 college presidents, Education Secretary Richard Riley says he wants to end the confusion over race-based scholarships. The Clinton administration supports them, Riley explains, because they enhance a diverse educational environment. In his letter, Riley advises that schools should not make any changes in their student financial aid programs. In 1990, the Bush administration abruptly banned them, saying that scholarships given to students just because of their race violated the 1964 Civil Rights Act. After a firestorm of protests from schools and civil rights leaders, the Bush administration said it was okay to give race-based scholarships as long as they were funded with private funds. Colleges demanded clearer guidelines. The General Accounting Office was ordered to look into the matter. That report is due in June, but Secretary Riley makes it clear that the GAO's findings will not affect the Clinton administration's support for race-based scholarships. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
Skip Young, known to millions of Americans as Wally on the television show The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, is dead. Officials say he was discovered in his home in California by family members yesterday morning. A coroner said that Young appeared to have died from natural causes. In recent years, Young was a radio personality. He was 63 years old. This is NPR News from Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. When Martin Scorsese read Richard Price's screenplay for Mad Dog and Glory, Scorsese said it was time that Price saw one of his screenplays made into a film that reflected what he'd actually written. That encouraged Price to become the executive producer of the movie. Price is happy with Mad Dog and Glory, even though the studio insisted on a happier ending than the one he had in mind. Scorsese is one of the producers of the film. They worked together before on The Color of Money and New York Stories. Price also wrote the screenplay for The Sea of Love and is now adapting his recent novel Clockers. Mad Dog and Glory continues Price's investigation into cops and killers. Robert De Niro stars as a mild-mannered police forensic photographer named Wayne, who inadvertently saves the life of a small-time gangster and bad stand-up comic, Frank, played by Bill Murray. To say thanks, Murray gives De Niro a present, a human present, a beautiful young woman played by Uma Thurman, who works at Murray's club. De Niro gets to keep her for a week. Of course, De Niro falls in love with her and doesn't want to hand her back over to the gangster.
The origin of the story was I was in Jamaica in the late 70s, and I hooked up with this Jamaican busboy at some hotel in Montego Bay. And he found out I had a car, and he said, "Oh, no, we got to go into the interior. We got to see my grandfather. I'll show you the island, you know, and get away from all these tourists." I said, "Fine." He shows up the next day, and he's got this blonde, lanky woman with him in a two-piece bathing suit, and her name is Dawn Rosenblum, and they're together, and I can't figure out what these two people are doing together. And I spent the whole day in a car with this guy and this girl, and they weren't talking to each other. I don't know, I couldn't figure it out. I thought, well, maybe she's one of these people who likes to go down, you know, and get down with the locals or something. I had no idea. But the day after that, I wound up on an airplane going back to Miami with her. And I asked her, I said, "Oh, is he your boyfriend?" She says, "No, well, you know, my friend Frank was down in Jamaica, you know, from Miami, and he went into the water too soon after eating, and he got a cramp, and this guy here jumped in and saved him. And when Frank came back from Miami, he said to me, well, baby, how'd you like a trip down to Jamaica? You can do me a favor, won't you?" And next thing I know, I'm standing by the Quonset huts behind this hotel where all the help lives, and knocking on the guy's door in a two-piece bathing suit with a sash that says, "Thanks, Frank." And, you know, she was like this human thank you present. And the story stayed with me. I don't know what this woman did, you know, when she's not in Jamaica. I don't know what her story was. I don't know who, quote-unquote, Frank from Miami is, but it sounds like if he's the type of guy who can get somebody like this to do him a favor like this, it's like, you know, yikes. And it just stayed with me for about 10 years before I figured out, you know, how to dramatize this triangle.
It's really funny that this premise of the human thank you present was actually something you found in real life. I thought, well, this is Richard Price really creating a very movie idea.
Well, no, actually, I mean, this is so politically offensive. I mean, I would never do it unless it, you know, it was
right.
Sometimes
right.
They say that, I think Norman Mailer once said that the defense of the bad writer is that something really happened, you know. But the fact of the matter is, it really happened. It just stayed with me. My mind doesn't work this way to make up things like this. You know, I'm too paranoid.
So the Bill Murray character is the character that you mentioned, Frank from Miami.
Frank from Miami might be. And, you know, once you got a character, you're going to say, all right, now how can I make this guy different than every other, you know, silk-suited golem we've ever seen, you know, in Crime Story and Miami Vice? And, you know, how do I make him not Tony Bentonos? And, you know, so I put him in therapy. You know, I made him a bad comedian. You know, you just try to find things, you know, a la Bill Forsyth or something. You know, I mean, you know, just take it someplace where it's never gone before, but not in a way that anybody's going to get a hernia over your inventiveness because it seems so inserted.
I love the idea of putting him in therapy because he's really trying to be sensitive now, and he really wants to be friends with the Robert De Niro character. And it's this gangster twist on the whole male sensitivo cliche.
Yeah, well, there was a scene that's been edited out of the movie because it was too long, in which he explains his relationship to his therapist, in which he says, my therapist is a degenerate gambler, and she's into me, you know, for God knows how much money. She can't pay it, so I take it out in sessions. I have three sessions a week, and, you know, she's in the hole for me for all these trips to Atlantic City.
Now, the Robert De Niro character is a cop who's a forensic photographer, and he takes pictures of bodies and crime scenes. He's not a tough guy. You've been hanging around with cops for a long time for your research for the film Sea of Love, for which you wrote the screenplay, for your novel Clockers, which is about cops and teenagers selling crack. Did you, in your years of hanging out with cops, meet anyone like the character De Niro plays, you know, a forensics guy who isn't a tough guy?
Cops are kind of like people, you know, which is to say that there's thousands, they're legion, you know, and some guys are going to be psychopaths and some guys are going to be fascists, you know, and other guys are going to be, you know, social workers, you know, and you know, bleeding hearts, believe it or not. I mean, you know, I don't particularly like or dislike cops. I mean, what I like is what you're allowed to see when you're with the cops. Because on one level, it's got to be the greatest show on earth. I mean, you're going to every situation in human experience in which mediation instantly is needed. I mean, you see human behavior in such extremists, you know, and that can really become addicting. As far as any cop that's kind of like Wayne, that's kind of like passive, is more like a photography buff than a hunter. Well, I hung out with the crime scene unit, the New York City crime scene unit, which are the forensic cops. Anytime there's a murder, they'll go to the scene, and what they have to do is preserve the scene. They'll bag the evidence, they'll photograph the body, they'll itemize the wounds, they'll lift the prints. Basically, they're not the hunters. They don't go after the bad guys. Well, basically what they're doing is memorializing the death scene. And that's a strange type of cop job. Now, most of these guys are on the other side of the 50-yard line in their career. You know, and it's kind of a sedentary type of job. You sit around waiting for the phone to ring, which means that the beast chewed up another one, and you got to pick up your, you know, your forensics kit, your death kit, and, you know, hot-foot it out to Brooklyn or Staten Island or wherever. And it's a strange type of job because it doesn't seem like they get affected by it because they've been doing it so long. Sort of like being a doctor or a nurse in an emergency room in an inner-city hospital. I mean, you're seeing so much bloodshed constantly that the only way you can function is to sort of, you know, be numb. I mean, you know, if you sob and cry over every wounded child or every dead body, it's like you can't function. And it's not normal to see as much death as they do and get that, you know, blatantly emotional about it. It's anything can become routine. And it just fascinated me.
Now, you wanted to make Bill Murray into a gangster that wasn't your standard movie gangster. I'm sure you wanted to do the same with the cop part of the movie. There's been so many crime films.
I wanted to make a movie where a cop movie in which there's not one shot fired. Well, there's two or three in this one, but basically I wanted with no shots fired and no car going over the speed limit and nothing bumping into anything else.
Well, in fact, you know, there's one scene that's very funny. Bill Murray's bodyguard and De Niro's partner are fighting, and they're about to crash into a glass window, and one of them warns the other, uh-oh, it's a window, we'd better move away. And you know, if this had been Lethal Weapon, it would have been a great special effects shot.
Well,
they'd crash through the window and fall onto the floor.
I'm not interested in that type of writing. I mean, it's like I'm trying to make a career out of giving people what they don't want, you know? you know, hey, you know, all innovation starts out as a bad mistake, you know? you know, it's like I'm in this business in which, you know, they're people want Count Chocula and they're trying to give them Count Chocula, and Frankenberry is considered bold, you know, and I'm trying to give them granola, you know, or I don't know, grape nuts. But, you know, it's like I'm in this, it's sort of like a tightrope that I'm doing. It's that I'm trying to write this stuff that you're not supposed to make on a studio level, but if I can do it good enough, maybe they'll do it anyhow.
De Niro plays the cop. I understand he had his choice of playing either the gangster or the cop.
Yeah, now originally Bob was going to play the, we call him Bob. Originally, De Niro was going to play the gangster, and you know Scorsese was in on the casting too. He was the other producer, mm-hmm. and you know it's just a reflex. Oh, you know, we got to get Bob for this, and we had a reading down at the Tribeca Film Center, and he got a whole bunch of actors, and we just sort of did a cold reading of the script, and we did it twice. First with Bob playing Frank, the mafia guy, and then we did it with Bob playing Wayne, the mild-mannered cop. And I think he felt at the end of the reading that, why should I play Frank? Because I always play Frank, or it's expected of me to play Frank. You know, and like, yeah, you know, every other actor, he wants to quote-unquote stretch his instrument or whatever you call it. And, you know, he figured this would be more interesting, more of a challenge for him.
Mm. How did you cast Bill Murray?
That was Bob's choice. I didn't think of him. I didn't know who we were going to get. It seemed like it would be so easy to get somebody that's intimidating, there's so many, you know, good actors out there who can play scary, but, you know, the hat trick, and so Bill Murray was not one of the guys I was thinking of. Not only was I not thinking of Bill Murray, but this guy had to be scary to Robert De Niro, Jake LaMotta, Travis Bickle, mm-hmm. you know, Max Cady, and so it seemed like, God, can Bill Murray scare Bob De Niro? But he did. I mean, you know, Bob has a way of shrinking or expanding or, you know, making his body and his face, you know, do like changeling tricks. And Bill was a great actor. He was just terrific. And in real life, I mean, you know, in terms of size, I mean, he could eat apples off De Niro's head. I mean, he's a big guy. I mean, you don't know that. And he's got that Irish face. You know, he's got like this hard Irish face, these cold eyes. You know, and that's not usually what he exploits in his roles. And, hey, everybody's stretching their instrument around here.
Mm-hmm. Richard Price is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for the new movie Mad Dog and Glory. He's also the executive producer of the film. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Price. We're talking about his new movie, Mad Dog and Glory. And he also wrote the novel Clockers, the screenplay for Sea of Love, and wrote many other novels as well. A couple of your novels were made into movies by other people. You had nothing to do with the screenplay. The Wanderers and...
Right.
What was the other one?
Blood Brothers.
Yeah, The Wanderers, Blood Brothers. Then you wrote the screenplay for Sea of Love. Now you've got a screenplay that you're also the executive producer of the film. So what does it mean to be the executive producer on this one?
Well, you know, an executive producer is sort of like a vanity thing. I mean, an executive producer is the ruler, like Queen Elizabeth is the ruler. You know, you get the hat and the check and, try to keep your family out of the tabloids. I mean, you know, now my power was more a veto power than any power to implement anything. Like, if they would offer me, like, some director, I'd say, oh, no way, no way. And they go, oh, okay. But if I myself went to Universal and said, hey, fellas, there's this guy who made this independent movie, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. It's probably the most horrifying thing I've ever seen. And I would like him to fly this $18 million Universal finance plane. I think they would have looked at me and they said, you're a writer. Shut up. You know, but I had Marty with me. I mean, after a year, I couldn't get anybody in there. I needed, you know, to have somebody with a little more firepower than myself to sort of second me or me second them in order for Universal to go along with it. And John McNaughton was really Marty Scorsese's find. And, you know, between me and Marty going to Casey Silver, who is sort of president of Universal, and saying, look, this guy's good. He's an independent guy. He's not some Hollywood hack. But I don't know if I would have had the power myself to go to Universal and say, hire this guy who did this thing about a serial killer to do a love story.
So you had to screen Mad Dog and Glory in front of test audiences, right?
Yeah, all pictures. And, mm-hmm. I mean, studios are basically enthralled to this into this focus group thing where basically they're asking people, what do you want? What do you like? Do you like it like this? Does this make you unhappy? What makes you unhappy? What can we do for you? How can you tell us how to make this to make the maximal amount of people happy? You know, and it's a business because it's so expensive to make any movie on a studio level that they can't take a chance on something that, I mean, they want everything that they could possibly do to make the maximal number of people coming out of the sixplexes happy enough to say to their friends, oh boy, you should see that picture. And it's a business. The danger of doing something that's original with a studio is they don't care how good this original thing is. The fact is we do not have any financial precedence for this type of what's it, ungenrefiable picture. If we felt that this picture was the child of Fatal Attraction and Sea of Love, we're very happy. But we don't know who the financial parents of this type of picture is. We don't know what's going to happen. We could be writing a $20 million check that's going to fall down a bottomless hole. You know, we don't know. We don't have any kind of track record on this type of picture because we don't even know what type this is. And it's too much money. It's too scary. So then originality becomes the ending, becomes the enemy.
When you were watching the test audience file into the movie theater, were you thinking, oh, no, not him. Oh, gosh, not her. She's not the kind of person who'd like my movie.
Well, you know, that's the funny thing. That's the dilemma of being an artist. You sort of, you know, on some level, you're obsessed with, you know, people liking what you do and all this praise and, well, people like this and how many people, I wonder what the reviews are going to say and are people smiling, are people laughing? But you don't know any of these people. It's completely anonymous and it's completely irrelevant, you know, to what's important in your life on a day-to-day basis. You know, they're not your family. You know, they're not your friends. They're just this sort of anonymous American public. So, yeah, you look at all these people and say, oh, look what that guy's wearing. I mean, the last time I wore stuff like that, I was a junior in high school, and I looked dorky even then. It's like, I didn't even know they made that color combination anymore. It's like, oh, God, look at that guy's haircut. What does he think he is, Metallica? I mean, it's like, oh, man. It's like, get these people out of here. I don't care about these people. You know, but these are the people. You know, I mean, it's very, you know, in an artist's mind, the public is very impersonal. It's just this one giant hand coming down to either slap or caress you. And then when you see the people, you know, it's like, who are these people to me? I don't know them. I don't dress like that. My hair's not like that. So eat that stuff. I don't take that crap into the theater. You know what that's going to do to your blood level, your blood sugar or whatever? You know.
Did you learn anything that you were glad you learned?
About what?
From the test groups, from the focus groups.
Well, yeah, but not from the scores and the numbers. I mean, you're in the crowd, and it's sort of like you're bobbing on an ocean, and you know when you're in a dip, and you know when you're in a wave. And when the original cut, there was a fight between De Niro and Bill Murray, and what I intended was De Niro was not even going to land a blow. I mean, the way it was originally written, this guy, he's no match for the mafia guy in a fight. And what I wanted and what they shot was basically De Niro getting his ass kicked terribly, but refusing to go down, refusing to go away until this Bill Murray character becomes so demoralized that hitting this guy who he really wanted as a friend, and he's so enraged at this guy because he's getting this beating for a dumb girl, you know, and this guy wants this girl so much more than he wants Bill Murray's friendship that he'll take any kind of beating in the world if it's going to win this girl's freedom from Bill Murray. And, you know, at some point, Bill Murray just can't hit this guy anymore. And then he realizes, you know, the depth of commitment that De Niro has. He's been jilted. this guy De Niro really wants this girl more than he wants Bill Murray's friendship. The problem with the fight was you can't have Bob De Niro in a fight not landing a punch, getting his head kicked in, and then all of a sudden Bill Murray just stops fighting because the decision to stop fighting was kind of internal. I mean, it's easy to write it, but, you know, you got to dramatize and physicalize and verbalize all this stuff. You know, all, and basically what you have on the screen is a guy getting his head kicked in, and then all of a sudden the other guy just stops. He puts his hands down, and he says, I'm this keeper, I don't care, and he walks away. And people in the audience went, what? What the hell did he stop fighting for? A, why didn't De Niro fight better, which is, not, you know, not my problem originally. And B, we don't understand why Bill Murray stopped hitting him. Why did Bill Murray stop the fight? Why did he say keep the girl? I mean, it turned out I could see it was not working dramatically and visually. People were not understanding why Bill Murray would stop hitting this guy. It was so perversely anticlimactic.
So did that make you think, gosh, this audience just isn't hip enough or smart enough to get it? Or did that make you think, I didn't do a good enough job in projecting the reason?
It's not their fault. It was my fault. Because what you have to perpetually learn as a screenwriter, that what plays beautifully on the page is not necessarily what's going to play beautifully on the screen. What's great dialogue on a page, it's not about the written word. It's about the spoken word. It's not about the written stage direction. It's about the acted stage direction. And what I realized is that what I was asking of the actors and the director in, you know, was to externalize a deeply and climactic internal moment. And it just couldn't be done, you know, and it was sort of my fault.
So having been screenwriter and executive producer on Mad Dog and Glory, are you ready to jump back in and do another film? Was this a good experience?
It was a rough experience. I'm real happy with the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, right now I'm finishing up the script for Clockers, which I'm doing with Marty Scorsese.
So he's directing it?
Nothing signed on the dotted line or anything, but, you know, nothing ever is, you know, nothing's for sure until the film's in the can.
Boy, you're going to give yourself a cameo in Clockers,
which
is about crack dealers and cops?
Of course.
Do you know what part you'd like to have?
I'll probably play like a white customer. They usually give me these
from the suburbs or something?
They usually give me these cameos where I play like a human stain. I had a great cameo in Mad Dog and Glory. I played that cop when De Niro's dancing around a cadaver in a restaurant.
What's it like for you to see yourself larger than life on screen, especially in a film with, you know, great actors?
It's 10 times worse. Well, do you know what it's like when you hear your voice on a tape recorder?
Yeah,
And you're kind of like grossed out and horrified. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's 10 times worse because it's your whole body in addition to your voice and your face, if you want to call it a face.
But it doesn't scare you enough to stop yourself from doing it again.
You know what? The funny thing about movies, it's so addicting. It's one time I ran into this novelist who had just written the screen version of his own novel, Who Shall Remain Nameless or Rename Nameless, and he was like a quivering. He was like this human fist. He was so enraged and traumatized by the experience. He was cursing at the director. He said he knew if he put in two extra lines for this actress, he could sleep with her, and he just used my script as, you know, like Spanish Fly, and was like, I guess this is my. He just walked all over me. And it was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, and I was thinking about you know, writing screenplays back in the 70s, and I listened to this guy. I said, oh God, I'm never going to do screenplays. And this guy, he just went on like the Ancient Mariner about what they did to him. And I said, oh my God, so what are you doing? He goes, well, I'm writing another script. You know, and that's, you know, it's what it is.
Well, I look forward to
your
next
movie. It's
like
that Woody Allen joke, my brother's a chicken, I'll cure him. No, we need the eggs.
We need the eggs, yeah. Well, hey, good luck with the next film.
Okay, thanks. Send me some Valium.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Okay.
Richard Price is the executive producer and screenwriter of the film Mad Dog and Glory. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the much-talked-about deficit. The president has proposed tax increases and spending cuts so he can cut the deficit. Why is the deficit such a big deal? We ask Robert Krolwich, CBS TV economics correspondent and former economics correspondent for NPR. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House will give President Clinton his first victory in Congress later tonight if, as expected, it approves a budget resolution and stimulus plan. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
House Democratic leaders pulled out the stops today to ensure smooth sailing for the president's proposal. They refused to give Republicans a chance to try to change the plan approved by the Budget Committee, and the Republicans' own substitute proposals were soundly defeated. For Democrats like Nancy Pelosi of California, this was their opportunity to show support for the first Democratic president in 12 years.
Give the president a chance. The American people want him to succeed. We should, too, in this House.
The House will vote late tonight on a $16 billion stimulus program, which, while less popular than the budget plan, is also expected to pass. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
According to diplomats in New York, a draft document has been approved by the UN Security Council that calls for sending up to 30,000 peacekeeping troops to Somalia. However, the measure will not be officially approved until suspended peace talks have resumed. Talks were called off when one factional leader walked out in protest over continued fighting in Kismayu. The conference is slated to continue this weekend or early next week after a fact-finding mission has traveled to the port city where fighting has continued. Several Los Angeles police officers testified today at the trial of four L.A. officers accused of depriving Rodney King of his civil rights. Most of the day has been spent in hearings with the jury out of the room. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW reports from Los Angeles.
So far, the defense has directed its energy at damaging the credibility of one of the strongest prosecution witnesses, use of force expert Sergeant Mark Conta. Conta testified that officers should have been able to apprehend Rodney King using the swarm technique, applying body pressure to a suspect's arms and legs. The defense has argued that the technique isn't taught to all recruits. Today they argue that LAPD Sergeant Robert Ontiveros should be allowed to testify about an informal survey he made of fellow officers, where only one said he'd learned the technique. Judge John Davies dismissed the survey as an unreliable exercise, and the testimony was not allowed in front of the jury. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Secretary of Defense Les Aspin underwent surgery this morning, and according to his doctor, all went well as a heart pacemaker was implanted. Aspin is expected to get out of the hospital by this weekend and be back at work sometime next week. Twice in the last 3 weeks, Aspin has been hospitalized with heart problems. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up close to 39 points to close at 3,465.64 on volume of 241 million shares. This is NPR News. Police in Bombay have arrested two men in connection with recent bombings in the city and accused those arrested of driving vehicles loaded with bombs to their targets. More than a dozen bombs exploded in the city nearly 1 week ago, and more than 300 people were killed. Police believe that terrorists were involved in the bomb attacks. Meanwhile, the death toll from a bombing in Calcutta is now put at 86. Officials are trying to see if that explosion was caused by a planted bomb or by stored explosives that blew up accidentally. The Italian Parliament has given the go-ahead for the former health minister to stand trial on charges of ballot rigging. Frances Kennedy reports from Rome.
The Italian Parliament voted by a narrow margin to lift the immunity for the former health minister, Francesco De Lorenzo, implicated in a vote-rigging scandal in Naples. De Lorenzo, a member of the Liberal Party, resigned last month after his father was arrested on corruption charges. De Lorenzo and two other members of Parliament are accused of having established a computer database of names of those who'd been granted jobs or other favours and who in exchange guaranteed their votes and those of their families. Under Italian law, members of Parliament have automatic immunity from prosecution. But as Italy's massive corruption scandal continues, magistrates have asked Parliament for permission to bring to trial numerous political figures. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Germany's central bank cut its key discount rate from 8 to 7.5% today after months of pressure from other nations. Key German rates were lowered 1 month ago, and the latest move comes after agreement on low-wage agreements between employers and trade unions, along with predictions of falling inflation in the nation. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. President Clinton has asked us to make financial sacrifices so he can cut the deficit. His economic plan calls for a new energy tax and increased taxes for wealthy Americans and corporations. The president is also calling for spending cuts in defense, Social Security, and Medicare and Medicaid payments to doctors and hospitals. To figure out if the sacrifices are justified, you need to understand what the deficit is all about. So as Congress debates the president's economic plan, we've invited Robert Krulwich to help us understand the much-talked-about deficit. Krulwich is a CBS TV economics correspondent and a former economics correspondent for NPR. Let's start with the basics. What's so bad about the deficit? Is it necessarily such a terrible thing?
Well, you know, it's not always a bad thing. Everybody has a little deficit of their own, a private deficit. Everybody owes money to somebody. The problem becomes if you owe so much money to somebody right now that you have to, that you're unable to afford either the necessities of life or you're so squeezed by your obligations that you have no freedom to make choices and new choices. And I guess the real question about the deficit is, are we now or are we approaching the point where we owe so much money to so many people that, A, the government doesn't have any room to maneuver, that we don't have, we can't start new programs. And remember, deficits are about debts. Those are about old obligations, things that have already happened. People think, well, what about the future? What about new challenges? Do we have enough money for new challenges when we're still paying off old obligations? And the second question about the deficit is, are we selfish as a generation right now? Are we gobbling up all kinds of services and making our kids pay for it? Those are the two things that I think most people worry about. The first question, are we in trouble because we're pinched? Not yet. But if the present pattern continues, if the United States does not get richer and richer and richer pretty fast year after year, then all the money that we owe, which is being added to every year, does begin to pinch and does make it much harder for us to create pools of money to address new problems and solve new issues. And as for our selfishness as a generation, I think it's a fair argument. Remember there was a very famous television ad in some campaign where a baby is born and you see him crying in the crib, and then this horrible-looking guy leans over the crib and says, "Happy birthday, welcome to the world. Here's your bill for $13,000, your part of the national debt." And the baby goes, "Wah!" That image, which is a very effective image, is not without some truth. If the baby's income is going to be $300,000 a year by the time he or she is 30, no problem. But if the baby's income is going to be close to our own incomes, then that would represent a big, big piece of that kid's taxes. Taxes that he or she will pay to pay for things that happened long ago in the 1980s and 1990s. And that, I guess, is a fair worry. The only caveat is if America in the next 20 years does become very competitive and very prosperous, then the fears of a looming deficit just diminish, just as if I told you, Terry, that you were about to become the anchorina of both NBC, CBS for $15 million a year, then whatever obligations you have would seem to diminish in your own mind and in reality.
Robert, is anybody arguing, hey, don't worry about the deficit, no big deal?
Yes. Lots of people are arguing that, and they have two arguments, or three. First say, it is a big deal, but it's not as big a deal as other deals, like getting people to work. That's an argument you hear a lot around the White House. Second deal is, we are going to be a prosperous nation. The jig is not up. We have a lot of ingredients that make it not only probable, but very likely that we will be a successful nation, and we don't have to be dragged down by this pessimism and whatever. And they have a number in their head. They say the proportion of money that we as a nation owe is smaller than it has been at other times in history. And at other times in history we pulled out, we can do it again. And the third argument against the deficit is the man on the street argument. Says, well, it's been around for a long time. Everybody on television says it's terrible, but I haven't felt anything. The whoopee answer.
How big is the deficit?
How big is it? It's about 4.1 and some trillion dollars, which, of course, makes no sense to anybody.
Yeah, it's hard for me to grasp what a trillion is.
Well, I have actually a little parlor trick for that. Let me ask you a question. Because the lesson of this will be just how big a trillion is. First of all, let's deal with the word a million. Where were you, Terry, a million seconds ago?
I have no idea. How much time is that?
Well, I'm not going to tell you. Just guess.
Well, it's easy. I was probably working here because I've been at it for years. It's the coward's way out of the answer.
The answer is it was 12 days ago. So wherever you were 12 days
ago.
All right. Now, a billion is, of course, a lot bigger than a million. So let me ask you the same question. When was, or where were you, a billion seconds ago, if you think you were alive?
Was I alive? I don't know.
Were you alive 31 years and 8 months ago?
Yes.
Then it was you alive when Jack Kennedy was, I guess, like maybe his third month in office?
Yes.
That's where a billion was. Now, I caution you for the next stage here. A trillion is so much bigger than a billion that all bars are off, or all holds are barred, or whatever the expression is. Where were you a trillion seconds ago, if you were anywhere?
I can see I was not born yet.
The date is 29,716 B.C. This is roughly the Stone Age. It's just after the discovery of fire. Now, if you go into the debt itself at $4.1 trillion or so, that's by rough calculation 120,350 years ago, which was before the invention of fire. So this is a very, very, very big number.
So there really is a big difference between a million, a billion,
yes,
and a trillion.
And if you stand at one of these calculators, like in New York City on 6th Avenue, they have the deficit is rising, and these numbers are going up by, you know, millions in no time at all, and billions very quickly, and the portions of trillion, like the second number, changes every month or so. It's just amazing.
My guest is Robert Krulwich, and he's an economics correspondent for CBS TV, former economics correspondent for National Public Radio. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Krulwich, economics correspondent for CBS TV. Where did the deficit come from?
Well, it goes way, way back. When the United States of America was first getting itself together, they had these Articles of Confederation, where each of the colonies had become, in effect, independent nation states. And then they decided to agree to hang together in a loose confederation, something along the model of the attempt to hang the old Soviet Union around a confederation. And it worked about as well. I mean, Virginians weren't getting along too well with Massachusettsonians, and there was a whole issue of how do we come together. When George Washington got in on the act, he and Hamilton decided that they could bribe the various states into a more perfect union if the U.S. government, the new baby U.S. government, assumed the debts of all the colonies. So, if you were looking at the very, 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 very bottom of the pile, down there in the very beginning, let's say somebody, I don't know, in Massachusetts lent some money to the town council of Lexington or whatever, and they promised to pay him back in 5 years or whatever, and that IOU when the United States was born, was assumed by the United States as an obligation of the United States, and they had to pay it off. When the 5 years came up, they probably borrowed money from someone else to pay back the loan, and so the note sort of stayed down there at the bottom of the pack. So it's very, very old. The United States of America as a country has never, ever eliminated the debt. They got really, really close once in the 1820s. Andy Jackson was elected president in 28, and in that time, 1828, and around then he decided that the Northwest Territories, that is a lot of Ohio, Indiana, and a good deal of the Great Lakes, sort of eastern Great Lakes area, should essentially had a fire sale. And he offered the land to farmers, I think it was for $1 an acre or $2 an acre. And a lot of people from Europe and all over came running over and paid the United States Treasury for plots of land. And the USA was swamped with money in 1827, 28 or so, thereabouts. And they got almost down to paying down all of the debts that they had done. It was very, very close to zero. At Inauguration Day, you remember, Andy Jackson had a big party, and everybody came in and ate the cheese and whatever. And about 3 years later, the deficit got off the sort of near bottom and began to go up again. And it has gone up in fits and starts ever since.
So some of the deficit goes back all the way to the beginning of the United States.
Well, even before the United States.
Right. How have we added to the deficit? What have been the major ways we have added to it more recently?
Well, the biggest ways are we go to war. Whenever we go to war, we borrow a huge amount of money to quickly build airplanes, tanks, guns, and buy ammunition and put everybody to work for the government. The government pays all the checks, and they borrow the money to do it. So there are gigantic increases in the debt in the United under Lincoln and the United States Civil War, huge increases in the World War I, a mountain of an increase during World War II, and then you get the Reagan years, which is of a different character. But I guess I should say one mechanical thing, because it is a little hard for people to understand. if Mr. Jones in Lexington, Massachusetts, lent the Bay Colony of Massachusetts, or whatever you call it, $20, and he expected to be paid back 5 years later, and if the United States government paid him back 5 years later, why do I say that that IOU is still in the pile? And the reason is, the United States of America, what happens is, when they came time to pay Mr. Jones, they went out and asked Mr. Adams to lend them, to lend $10, and they used Adams's $10 to pay Jones. And this is a very normal thing with government debt. When it's time to pay the bill on Monday to somebody, they go out and borrow money from somebody else to pay the bill that they have to pay on Monday. So in a technical kind of way, you can say that the original obligation to pay $20 is still there because they never really paid it off. They just borrowed money from someone else. It's literally borrowing from Peter to pay Paul.
Well, the United States government borrows money
to
pay back some of the national debt. Who does it borrow from?
Well, that's a good question, because mostly it borrows, until very recently, it borrows from Americans. So a lot of people think, well, so what's the big deal? The United States government is borrowing money from Americans, which means that every year it has to pay interest to Americans. So the money doesn't really leave the country and go to Japan or Germany. The money stays here. So what's the big deal? Well, there's two big deals. First of all, the people who can lend money to the government tend to be richer because they have money to lend. So in a way, this is a transfer payment. Taxpayers pay in money, rich and poor, to Washington. Washington takes out of that pile a larger and larger sum of money every year and pays it back to its creditors, to Mr. Fitzhugh in his fancy car, who has got U.S. bonds and so on. And so there is a transfer payment from the poor to the rich. The debt does have that effect. And also, B, as we all know, for a while in the 1970s and 1980s, starting with sheikhs from the Middle East and then Italians and Brits and Dutch people, and then increasingly Japanese people, foreigners began to buy U.S. treasuries, which means that when it comes time for the U.S. to send its interest check, it is sending that wealth, our wealth, out of America, and that would arguably diminish America's wealth. However, you want to know who's paying for the debt right now?
Who?
You. When you put your money in a bank or a savings and loan these days, it's amazing right now, but almost because bankers are so scared after the savings and loan crisis and so worried about lending to commercial enterprises after the tremendous crashes in real estate and so nervous about lending to foreigners after Brazil and whatever, that they love the idea of being able to pay you 2.5% interest on your savings account and take your money and go to the United States government and lend your money to the U.S. government for the deficit and get 5.5% or 6%. That's a wonderful spread at no risk, because unlike Brazil and unlike the 1066 Wilshire Boulevard or whatever, the real estate client that looks good on Monday and doesn't pay on Friday, the United States of America always pays its debts. So the bankers basically overwhelmingly in the last few years have taken a huge amount of the money that you and I bank in our banks, and lent it to cover the debt. So when the United States of America goes and asks the entire world, could you lend us money this week, which they do every week, most of the hands that go up, we will, in the room, are American bankers lending American deposits to the United States of America.
So you and I are paying with lower interest rates. We're not making a lot of money on the money in the bank.
Our banks are making money.
Mm-hmm.
Which I suppose we would like, since we don't want them to collapse anymore, but which after a while gets your goat. Because every time you walk into the automatic teller and they charge you 55 cents per transaction, and every time you call up your banker to say hello and he says, that will be $3.45, please, what else? it gets to be irritating that they're also getting, in effect, a subsidy from the U.S. government.
So the way that people, the way that Americans lend money to the government for the debt is through buying treasury bonds.
Yeah. If you get rid of the word treasury bonds, which sounds inexplicable, it's just an IOU. What you want to know what actually happens, and you can actually dial the number if you want. There's a telephone number which is answered by a man with the most remarkable New York accent you'll ever want to hear, which tells you every day of the week how much money the United States of America wants to borrow from the whole world. So this guy gets you dial the number. And you get on the phone, you hear, he says, this week, the New York Treasury, New York Federal Reserve has an auction on Monday at 10 a.m. Bids will be received for whatever it is, at quarter, for the outside quarter. Make yourself post off market quarter. This is a public announcement. If you wish to hear the results of this market quarter, dial the following number. And then you do, if you want to hear. And then what happens is at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a representative of the United States of America, in effect, goes before the whole world, or there's actually a room, and there's an auction, and he says, I have here an IOU from the U.S. government. We want to borrow, $10,000, we want to borrow $1 billion in $10,000 amounts, and how much would you pay, how much interest would you want to receive this IOU? And so, 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a week, the United States asks the whole world for money. The whole world comes to market and offers the United States, demands various interest rates from the United States. The United States chooses the lowest interest rate that will be able to raise the money. It's just a regular old classic auction. And then they announce it on that telephone call.
My guest is Robert Krulwich. We'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the economy?
Well, we have news of today's action on Capitol Hill on the president's economic program. Also, we'll be hearing from a Harvard labor economist who generally supports the program but takes issue with the idea that small business is the great creator of new jobs in the American economy. We'll have letters from our listeners, a story about wood stoves, and also the latest news about the Clinton administration's health reform proposals, and to talk with West Virginia Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller about price controls and his view about why, in the short term, price controls would be necessary.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Robert Krolwich, CBS TV economics correspondent, former economics correspondent for NPR. President Clinton, I think, is trying to do two things with his economic plan. One is to cut the deficit,
right,
and the other is to stimulate the economy.
Right.
What's the thinking behind the thinking on this?
Well, as you indicate from your tone of voice, these are not necessarily complementary goals in the short term. In the next few years, let's say, next couple of years, if he spends a humptagatillion dollars to create jobs, that is, as everybody who thinks knows, going to add to the deficit and will create a bigger deficit, not a smaller one, unless he cuts everything else, which is very, very unlikely. So if he's going to launch a big government spending program to stimulate the economy, he has a problem if at the same time he wants to cut the deficit. So that's true. However, it's a different picture in the long term. And it is in the long term where President Clinton mentally and emotionally seems to dwell. He looks at the United States and he sees short-term problems, but he's interested in long-term solutions. And it is his guess that if he can put in place a set of government programs that create educated or more educated people, incentives for small businessmen to hire those more educated people, and a infrastructure that allows them to zing-zang information around the country and around the world, that he will create at least the launching pad for a prosperous country. And he thinks that that, of course, if a country does become prosperous, will produce the wealth that will solve the deficit problem. So whether you're for or against President Clinton's plan, I suppose the way to analyze his plan is to focus either in the short term and then draw a line, because you're not talking about the same thing, or talk about the long term and whether his formula will work. But it is about two different goals in two different time frames.
I read that there's a recovery going on. Should I be feeling that?
Yeah, of course you should.
How?
Well, people around you should be less worried about losing their jobs. People around you should be less worried about their friends and families losing income from whatever source. People around you should be thinking about asking the boss for a higher raise. People around you should be thinking about buying the pair of shoes or the sofa or the wall-to-wall carpet or the washer-dryer that they'd had their eyes on for a long time. Appetites should be rising, fear should be dropping, and that's what classically happens in a recovery on the street. People feel, A, a little better about the future, B, less frightened, and C, they pay more attention to their appetites for all kinds of stuff.
I'm not sure that's exactly what I've been seeing. What about
you? No, a lot of people have. Well, you're not living in Cleveland, and you're not living in Omaha, and you're not living in Austin, or you're not living in some places where I think, or in Denver, where those things are going on. A lot of people are living in places where that isn't happening yet. Let's take California aside. I think most places in the United States are either at a bottom, like that people don't think things are going to get worse, or they're beginning to rise. California is the exception. So a lot of this depends on where you live and where you sit and who your friends are.
Robert Krolwich is economics correspondent for CBS This Morning. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Joan Tuohy, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, one of the great voices of rock music, Neil Young. MTV has been repeating its Unplugged concert with him, and that's inspired us to rebroadcast our recent interview with him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.